You're listening to an African Elements top news story for June 17, 2026. Please visit our website at africanelements.org for more daily news. How redlining controls who survives modern storms. As severe weather fronts push across the American South, grassroots environmental coalitions are mobilizing. Intense heat waves, unpredictable flooding, and rapid fire storms continue to batter the region. This localized campaign is not merely a response to immediate weather alerts. Instead, it is a direct confrontation with a historical legacy of systemic discrimination. For decades, discriminatory real estate practices and structural underfunding have left low-income Black and brown communities disproportionately exposed to extreme climate events. To understand why these grassroots groups are mobilizing today, one must explore the history behind the headlines. The birth of the environmental justice movement, the enduring scars of redlining, and the current battle for funding explain this modern struggle. These communities do not rely entirely on state or federal relief, choosing instead to organize their own survival networks. The modern intersection of civil rights and environmental advocacy was born in the American South. In 1982, the state government decided to place a hazardous waste landfill in rural, predominantly Black Warren County, North Carolina. The facility was built to store soil contaminated with polychlorinated biphenyls, known as PCBs. PCBs are highly toxic, man-made chlorinated organic chemical compounds widely used in industrial applications, such as electrical transformers. These chemicals enter the environment through spills, leaks, or illegal dumping. In North Carolina, a trucking company illegally sprayed PCB-laden oil along 240 miles of rural roads. PCBs are carcinogenic and pose severe health risks, including developmental delays and reproductive issues.
Local residents and national civil rights leaders staged 6 weeks of nonviolent protests, resulting in over 500 arrests. Although protests failed to stop the landfill construction, the facility suffered rapid structural failures. By 1993, rainwater breached the landfill cap, causing 13 feet of rainwater to pool inside. This water threatened to leak and contaminate the local drinking water wells. State testing in 1994 discovered toxic dioxins in monitoring wells. Refusing to let the toxic waste be dumped elsewhere, activists forced the state to detoxify the soil on site. Between 2002 and 2003, a joint state and federal remediation project spent $18 million to heat the soil and destroy the PCBs. The site remains heavily restricted for future development. The Warren County protests galvanized civil rights organizations to study the systemic targeting of minority neighborhoods. In 1987, a landmark national report forever transformed the academic understanding of environmental issues. The acronym UCC refers to the United Church of Christ, a progressive Christian denomination. The UCC Commission for Racial Justice played a pioneering role by bridging faith-based civil rights advocacy with environmentalism. Led by Dr. Benjamin F. Chavez Jr., who coined the term environmental racism,
the commission published Toxic Wastes and Race in the United States. The study statistically demonstrated that race was the single most potent variable in predicting where commercial hazardous waste facilities were located. It proved more significant than household income or property values. This national report was supported by other critical research. A 1983 General Accounting Office study revealed that 3 out of 4 commercial hazardous waste landfills in the South were located in predominantly Black communities. Later, Dr. Robert Bullard documented these patterns in his landmark book, Dumping in Dixie. Dr. Bullard showed how segregation systematically directed municipal waste and chemical refineries into politically disenfranchised neighborhoods. This struggle connected directly to historical fights for economic rights and fair working conditions. The pioneering work of the UCC and early researchers established the foundations of contemporary environmentalism, eventually influencing federal environmental policy. To comprehend why Southern grassroots coalitions are mobilizing, one must look at the blueprint of urban segregation. In 1933, the federal government established the Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOLC, to prevent foreclosures. The HOLC created color-coded residential security maps for over 200 cities to evaluate mortgage lending risks. These maps divided neighborhoods into 4 distinct color-coded categories. Blue line zones represented grade B, which was labeled still desirable. These areas were stable, middle-class neighborhoods with low investment risks, populated almost exclusively by white homeowners. Yellow-lined zones represented grade C, which meant definitely declining. Evaluators flagged yellow-lined neighborhoods as higher risk due to aging housing stock, higher concentrations of renters, and the presence of working-class families or ethnic minorities. Even if these yellow-lined neighborhoods were mostly white at the time, the potential presence of minority groups led to systematic downgrading. Grade D areas were redlined and deemed hazardous, locking out Black and immigrant residents from receiving home loans. Although the Fair Housing Act of 1968 outlawed these practices, the physical infrastructure of these neighborhoods remained deeply neglected. Starved of capital for decades, formerly redlined and yellow-lined communities suffered an environmental capital deficit. This history directly explains why residents in these neighborhoods face disproportionate climate threats today.
The lack of investment in formerly redlined zones left behind physical vulnerabilities that worsen modern climate events. To understand the flooding risks in these neighborhoods, one must analyze pervious and impervious surfaces. Impervious surfaces are solid, human-made materials, such as concrete, asphalt, and rooftops. These materials completely prevent rainwater from absorbing naturally into the ground. In contrast, pervious surfaces include natural soil, grass, and wetlands. Pervious areas allow rainwater to filter down and recharge groundwater supplies naturally. When developments replace pervious green spaces with impervious concrete, rainwater converts entirely into rapid surface runoff. This surface runoff flows at a much faster velocity and in larger volumes. Consequently, it easily overextends outdated municipal drainage systems, causing catastrophic local flooding and sewer backups. Furthermore, the lack of tree canopy in heavily paved, formerly redlined neighborhoods creates intense urban heat islands. Formerly redlined neighborhoods are, on average, 5 degrees hotter in the summer than non-redlined neighborhoods in the same city. In some starker urban areas, this temperature difference can soar up to 13 degrees hotter. This unequal pavement distribution directly dictates who burns and who floods. Southern municipalities have repeatedly failed to upgrade drainage, sewage, and green infrastructure in formerly redlined neighborhoods. Although the federal government banned explicit housing discrimination in 1968, local southern governments continued to direct capital improvements elsewhere. They directed tax revenues and federal capital improvements toward newly developing, predominantly white suburban neighborhoods. Older minority residential neighborhoods were consistently placed last on capital improvement lists.
Many municipal planning commissions adopted local zoning ordinances that used the 1930s maps as a baseline. This practice codified and perpetuated environmental inequities for decades. Post-1968 municipal budgets in major southern cities were often shaped by policies of planned shrinkage and benign neglect. These policies actively withheld resources from aging minority urban centers. Furthermore, formerly redlined communities suffered from suppressed home values. This lack of wealth accumulation severely limited the local property tax revenues available to fund expensive infrastructure upgrades. These persistent disparities have fueled modern calls for systemic redress to repair decades of state-sponsored disinvestment. And without structural interventions, extreme weather will continue to overwhelm these neglected communities. In response to this systemic neglect, Southern grassroots coalitions are taking action. The Deep South Center for Environmental Justice is currently driving critical initiatives to protect vulnerable residents. In January 2026, the organization launched the Louisiana Gulf Coast Grantmaking Project. This project provides direct funding to frontline coastal communities, building local capacity to manage storm mitigation and flood resilience infrastructure. Additionally, the Power to the People Coalition actively trains community groups to advocate for climate-ready housing. A major focus of this coalition is home weatherization. Weatherization is a series of physical modifications designed to improve energy efficiency and optimize indoor climate control. These physical home modifications entail using caulk, expanding foam, and weather stripping to seal air leaks around windows, doors, and plumbing. Workers also install high-performance insulation in attics and crawl spaces.
Weatherization protects residents by lowering heating and cooling bills by an average of 15%.
It stabilizes indoor temperatures during extreme heat waves and severe winter storms.
Finally, sealing the home envelope keeps out humidity, mold, dust, and pollen, which improves overall respiratory health. Building scientific leadership within marginalized communities is essential for long-term climate adaptation. The acronym HBCU stands for Historically Black Colleges and Universities. Co-founded in 2011 by Dr. Robert D. Bullard and Dr. Beverly Wright, the HBCU Climate Change Consortium is highly relevant because most HBCUs are situated in southern states facing severe climate impacts and industrial pollution.
The annual conference provides Black and Brown students with a platform to present peer-reviewed climate research, helping overcome the systemic educational barriers that historically limited minority representation in STEM fields. Simultaneously, grassroots coalitions like Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services, known as TEJAS, fight on the front lines of chemical refinery corridors in Houston. Language access has emerged as a critical social justice issue for industrial accident warnings in this region. Highly toxic chemical plants border residential neighborhoods populated primarily by Spanish-speaking families with limited English proficiency. Historically, authorities have issued emergency alerts almost exclusively in English, leaving thousands unable to understand life-saving warnings during petrochemical fires. Nonprofit groups argue that a lack of bilingual warning systems is a form of environmental discrimination. Since the Houston Ship Channel region experiences an explosion every 6 weeks, immediate bilingual emergency alerts are a constant necessity. Despite the critical work of these southern coalitions, funding for grassroots environmental justice groups remains dangerously low. A comprehensive 2025 analysis of 50 of the most influential U.S.
climate foundations revealed that only 3% of climate funding actually reaches grassroots, community-led climate justice groups. Making matters more challenging, a January 2026 survey found that 24% of corporate philanthropy leaders plan to scale back environmental justice initiatives due to political pushback. Leaders face an aggressive political and legal backlash that intensified after the U.S. Supreme Court's 2023 ruling ending affirmative action in college admissions.
Conservative legal groups and state attorneys general have targeted corporations with lawsuits and civil rights investigations, alleging that race-conscious environmental initiatives constitute unlawful discrimination. Approximately 50% of corporate executives surveyed cited a rising fear of class action litigation as the primary factor behind reducing their diversity budgets. High-profile pressure campaigns have led major corporations to eliminate dedicated diversity, equity, and inclusion roles. To avoid costly litigation and conservative consumer boycotts, corporate leaders are choosing to scale back their social and environmental programs. This shift places the financial burden entirely onto grassroots donors and community-led fundraising. On March 26, 2026, progressive lawmakers announced the formation of the House Environmental Justice Caucus to ensure frontline communities have a voice in federal climate budgeting. It is crucial to understand what concrete authority this newly formed caucus possesses. The organization is officially registered as a Congressional Member Organization, CMO. Under congressional rules, caucuses do not possess direct legislative power, budgetary authority, or the ability to allocate federal funds. Standing committees and the full House of Representatives hold those powers exclusively. The authority of the House Environmental Justice Caucus is strictly advisory, educational, and symbolic.
The caucus serves to build bicameral coalitions, conduct administrative oversight, and amplify grassroots organizations. It also provides frontline, underrepresented communities with structured, institutional access to lawmakers to ensure their voices help shape federal climate policy, even if the caucus itself cannot directly pass laws. These localized efforts mirror the historical resistance strategies that Black communities have long used to survive systemic neglect. By taking resilience into their own hands, Southern grassroots coalitions are rewriting the blueprint of climate survival. Copyright, African Elements.